Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this last day of September. James Swanson is our guest this hour, and guess what? We get to talk about Abraham Lincoln. It's been over a year, I think. Not just Lincoln, but also Jefferson Davis. James has a new book. He is the author, you'll recall, of Manhunt, bestseller in this country. The new book is Bloody Crimes, The Chase for Jefferson Davis and the Death Pageant for Lincoln's Corpse. James is the Edgar Award-winning author of Manhunt. He has degrees in history from the University of Chicago and in law from the University of California. He's worked for a number of think tanks in Washington, including he spent time at the United States Department of Justice, serves on the advisory council of Ford's Theater Society. He was born on Lincoln's birthday. How about that? And he has studied and collected books, documents, photographs, art, and artifacts from Abraham Lincoln's life and death since he was 10 years old. My kind of guy. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, James. Thanks so much for being with us. Oh, I got the wrong thing here. Here we go. Hi, James.
Hi.
Hi. We got you in the right spot now. Thanks for being with us. And for
My pleasure.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't known very much about Jefferson Davis, so I love the way you put the two of them in this incredible time in American history together, what one was doing, what the other was doing. I just didn't know that much about Davis, who's a compelling guy.
Yes. Well, that's one reason I wrote the book. When I finished Manhunt, I thought I'd finished writing about this subject. But then a lot of readers said, well, what happened next? What happened in the Confederacy? What happened to Lincoln after he was shot and after Booth was captured? And I realized that the story of the assassination and the manhunt for Booth was really part of a trilogy of three amazing, thrilling adventures that were taking place at the end of the Civil War. One was certainly this death pageant for Lincoln that brought his body home to Springfield. And the other was Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, on the run for 6 weeks, being hunted down by Union cavalry. And I was stunned to learn some of the things I found about Jefferson Davis, because he is certainly the lost man of American history. We know nothing about him today. What do people remember about him? What do they know about him, except perhaps his name? And I think we've forgotten that once upon a time, prior to the Civil War, it was Jefferson Davis and not Abraham Lincoln who was viewed as the great man of achievement. He was a congressman, a senator, war hero, secretary of war, a popular leader in the Senate. Everyone assumed that Jefferson Davis was likely going to become president of the United States one day at a time when most Americans had never even heard the name Abraham Lincoln.
Hmm. And he might have been elected in 1860, you write, if it had not been for the party being splintered.
Yes, if Jefferson Davis was the Democratic Party candidate for president in 1860, which he turned out not to be, and the Democrats didn't have two candidates and split the vote, Davis could very well have been elected president of the United States, because Abraham Lincoln received only 39.8% of the popular vote. 60% of the voters in that presidential election voted for someone other than Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. Boy, there's something to think about. What if Davis had been president of the United States? It just sort of is. It stops you in your tracks for a minute, doesn't it?
Well, I think a couple things would have happened. There probably would not have been a civil war, and 620,000 Americans would not have been killed in that war. That's the good side. The downside is, if Jefferson Davis had been president of the United States, slavery might have continued in America indefinitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go to the end of his life for a moment before we go back to Abraham Lincoln. I didn't realize there was a great deal of pressure on the part of many to hang the man because they thought he was behind the assassination of Lincoln, which he wasn't. So he's making this trip farther and farther south and gets captured and then he's released. But he starts doing speeches after his release to various places in the South, and how he was received.
Yes, it's truly amazing. I didn't know about this when I started the book, and it just struck me as an amazing tale. Jefferson Davis outlived Abraham Lincoln by almost a quarter of a century.
Goodness.
By 24 years. He was released after a couple of years in prison. And then he tried to figure out what to do. He was president of an insurance company, but that failed. He traveled the world. His family was separated. He lived an unsettled life until he figured out what to do. And that was to be the memory keeper in chief for the Confederate dead. He started writing articles, giving some talks. He spoke at the death of Robert E. Lee in 1870. And Davis became viewed as the representative man of the South. People said, he suffered for us. He was imprisoned for us. He helped save the South from repression at the end of the war. But then he didn't still speak a lot. He didn't seek office. He wouldn't take the loyalty oath to the Union. He said, if I take that oath, I could be elected to any office in the South. But he wouldn't do it because he thought he was going to betray the Confederate dead if he said they were wrong. Then, just a few years before the end of his life, when he was looking forward to his 80th birthday and he was a little surprised that he had lived that long because he had lifelong health problems, he received an invitation to go to Alabama to dedicate the sculpture for the Confederate dead. He thought it was just going to be another talk. He was stunned to find tens of thousands of people waiting for him. Old Confederate widows dressed in black laid hands upon him and collapsed at his feet. Old Confederate veterans, some missing arms or legs, wearing their tattered old uniforms, touched him, and they would begin shaking uncontrollably. And then he gave one of the most eloquent, moving speeches of his life that drove people to a frenzy, according to newspaper accounts.
Lincoln, I just love this man so much. There's so much to him. Wanted Davis to escape unbeknown to him, you write, that Lincoln was not a vengeful man. I shall do nothing in malice. What I deal with is too vast for malicious dealing.
Yes, one of Lincoln's greatest statements. Even when Lincoln went to Richmond a day and a half after it fell, the city was still burning. Lincoln could smell the smoke. He walked through the city, which is the most dangerous thing an American president has ever done. Anyone could have opened a window and shot him.
Right,
Lincoln himself said, I'm surprised that no one killed me when I walked through Richmond. So he goes to the Confederate White House. He sits in Jefferson Davis's chair in his study. Now, that could have been a great moment of exultation. But all Lincoln said was, I'm tired. May I have a glass of water? It had taken 620,000 lives to travel less than 100 miles from Washington to Richmond. And then, in the spirit of no malice, a general said, well, what shall we do with the rebels? And Lincoln said, let them up easy. Let them up easy. He didn't want to prosecute anyone, Lee, Davis, anyone. Lincoln told General Sherman and others, I hope he just gets away. Just let him go. I don't want to know what he does. Let him escape. Maybe he'll go to Mexico. Maybe he'll go to Europe. Lincoln knew that to try and execute the Confederate leaders for treason would ensure that the nation couldn't be brought back together for another 100 years. It would have so embittered the South to execute all its leaders. Lincoln wanted to show mercy to everyone.
Yeah, quite something. I love the description of how he was greeted in Richmond by African-American citizens. Can you describe that?
Yes, Lincoln was in the field with General Grant. It's not remembered often that Lincoln didn't spend much of the last couple of weeks of his life in his White House. He took to the field, and he took a riverboat to Grant's headquarters. He visited soldiers. He saw graves being dug. He visited the wounded. He met with his top generals. Lincoln loved being in the field with his army, not just the generals. Lincoln loved the common soldiers, and he loved to be with them. And when he heard that Richmond had fallen and Davis had fled, he sent a telegram back home to Washington. I think I shall visit Richmond tomorrow. So he went on a U.S. naval vessel, and he got in a rowboat with 12 soldiers and his son Tad and a couple officers. They rowed ashore. Lincoln got on the dock. No one was waiting for him. No guards, no army, no nothing.
Isn't that something?
And then some freed slaves noticed him. And they rushed to him and began cheering his name. Some of them did acrobatics and somersaults. Some began dancing. And then hundreds more gathered within minutes. And they serenaded Lincoln with songs. They bowed and they kneeled. And Lincoln, who was a very humble man, said, do not bow to me. Bow only to God. You are free now. And then he walked through the city, and thousands of people gathered and worshipped him, which embarrassed Lincoln because he thought he was a humble man elevated temporarily to the presidency, and he didn't like the imperial trappings of presidential power. And Lincoln was actually quite embarrassed to see the freed slaves come to worship him. He didn't think he deserved that.
Hmm. He was, as I was reading about his involvement with following what was going on with the war, that he was a great fan of the telegraph office and would go over there frequently. I think it put him in modern times, thinking that he would have been an internet user, right? He
would have been... more so than that, Abraham Lincoln would have been a BlackBerry addict today, or an iPhone addict, because he haunted that telegraph office in Washington at all hours of the day or night. And he got to know the telegraph operators quite well, and some of them wrote memoirs about him. When he was in the field with the Army, he was often writing telegrams and sending them back to Washington. It's like Lincoln was a war reporter in the field sending news back to Secretary of War Stanton and the War Department. He would say, "We captured X thousand men today and 22 cannon and 30 rebel flags. General Grant says this. Sherman says this." Lincoln also sent a wonderful telegram to Grant saying that... "I'm told that if pressed, Lee will surrender." And then Lincoln underlined this in the telegram, and he said, "Let the thing be pressed."
And then on the other side, you've got this total lack of communication at a time when you needed communication between Lee and Davis.
Yes, they were in communication while Davis was in Richmond. Richmond was in jeopardy, but Davis didn't think he would have to abandon it on that Sunday, April 2nd. The Army of Northern Virginia was fighting furious battles outside the city and outside Petersburg, and they were in regular communication by telegram and by messenger. And then when Davis was in church Sunday morning on April 2nd, a telegram was brought in, and everyone in the church watched this aide march up the aisle and hand a piece of paper to Davis, who was sitting in the front row. And witnesses said David read this, turned as white as a ghost, got up, and left the church. It was the message from Lee saying, "You must abandon the capital tonight. I must move my army away or it will be destroyed." But then once Davis got on the move and he took that train that night to Danville, and Richmond burst into flames a few hours later and the core of the city was destroyed, they could not communicate as well. Davis was moving, Lee was moving, and they could not communicate at all in real time. So Davis did not know Lee's every move, and Lee did not hear regularly from Davis. Davis did not authorize the surrender on April 9th by Lee. It came as a crushing surprise. And Davis, for a time, was quite irritated because he didn't think Lee had to surrender. He thought Lee should have swung away from Richmond and moved south, met up with him, and then gone into North Carolina to unite with Joseph Johnston's army. And so Lee... disappointed Davis, and he sent a message to Davis explaining why he had to surrender. And then a few days later, he sent another letter to Davis pleading with him to surrender all forces and end the Civil War. But because of poor communications, Davis never even saw that letter.
Isn't that something? And we should say Davis at this time is heading south, heading further south. He keeps going to different states. Why is that? North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, ultimately.
Yes. Well, Davis decided that he wanted to continue the war. As long as there were Confederate soldiers in the field, even if Lee had surrendered, he had the army in North Carolina, he had an army west of the Mississippi River in Texas. So Davis was not running just to save his life. It wasn't like John Wilkes Booth, a mad flight to escape as quickly as he could. Davis was doing an orderly retreat, accompanied by his cabinet, by officials, by boxes of documents he thought he would need to carry on the war. And so he was moving south, and his first stop was Danville, 140 miles southwest of Richmond. And there he opened up the new Confederate capital for several days. And then when more bad news came, he moved south, and he went into North Carolina, to Greensboro, to Charlotte, then to South Carolina. The news kept getting worse and worse, and Davis's personal guard and escort started to get smaller and smaller. And one by one, his cabinet members would peel off, leaving him more alone, until at the very end of the six-week chase, he was with his wife, his children, and approximately 20 aides and guards hiding in a forest in Georgia.
Hmm. We have to talk about, because this is all centered in 1 month, actually, which is absolutely phenomenal. One of the most, and I think you're absolutely right, important months in all of American history, all that happened during this month. Abraham Lincoln, let's go to some of the dreams he was having during this time. I don't know if it was before the fall of Richmond or after. He started having dreams about his death, and he must have been very aware that anybody could knock him off here because he wasn't a beloved figure in certain parts of America. When did he start thinking he had this good news, thinking that the war was very close to ending, but also this premonition?
Yes, Lincoln, he had two types of dreams. One was a recurring dream that he discussed at the last cabinet meeting the day he was shot. He dreamed often that he was at the prow of a ship sailing rapidly towards a dark and distant shore. And Lincoln told his cabinet, "I had that dream again last night, and something important is about to happen." In our favor, Lincoln believed, because he said whenever he had that dream, an important event happened after it. Little did he know that his own death was the important thing that was going to happen. And then there's another singular dream. We can't be absolutely sure that Lincoln dreamed this because it was reported by one of his closest friends, but not till several years later, but it certainly sounds Lincoln-esque. Lincoln dreamed he awoke in the White House, and he heard sounds and crying, and he wandered from room to room and came to the East Room and found a coffin at the center of the room with people gathered around it. And Lincoln said, "Who is dead in the White House?" And a woman turned to him and said, "The president." He was killed by an assassin. And then Lincoln is alleged to have said, "And I could sleep no more that night." I suspect that dream was by Abraham Lincoln and not made up by that friend who wrote about it several years later. It so fits the way Lincoln thought and spoke that I do believe that he had that dream.
What were his thoughts, and what did people do in Washington after the fall of Richmond? There were wild celebrations. People thought that this was the end of the war?
Many did, because at the beginning of the war, the Union Army went into the field with the cry, "On to Richmond." They thought it would be so easy. They thought it would take one big battle. Well, as soon as the Battle of Bull Run happened in July 1861, they learned it was going to take longer and be bloodier. And so when the news came to Washington that Richmond had fallen, the city held a jubilee. 500 cannon fired. People ran into the streets. They celebrated all day. There were torchlight parades. Thousands of people got drunk in the saloons and taverns of the city. It was one of the happiest days in American history. It's hard to imagine a celebration like that today. The sense of relief that the bloodshed was over, Richmond had fallen. I would have loved to have been in Washington, D.C., the first week of April 1865, to experience the jubilation in the Capitol upon learning the news that they thought the war was over. Yes, Lee was still out there, but Lincoln knew that it was inevitable. At some point, Lee would have to surrender. Lincoln knew on April 3rd, when Richmond fell, that the war was won. It was entering its final stages, and that's why he wanted to stay in the field with the army. He wanted to personally experience the victory in the field with his troops.
But if you had been there for the jubilation and stayed for the month, oh my goodness, the tragedy that was just a week or so away.
Yes. In fact, when I wrote my last book, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer, at some talks I gave, a few people said, "Well, would you have liked to have been in Ford's Theater that night to witness the assassination of Abraham Lincoln?" And I said, no, that terrible tragedy I wouldn't want to see. But I would have liked to have seen Lincoln enter Ford's Theater on the night of April 14th. Victory was in the air. Richmond had fallen. Lee had surrendered. People were celebrating all week. Lincoln arrives late for the play. The theater is full. The play is underway. He walks in, ascends the stairs, and walks along the back of the theater heading to his box. People know he's arrived. The actors stop speaking. The band orders "Hail to the Chief." It was a cool spring evening, moisture in the air, the smell of the gas lamps illuminating the stage. And then the people cheered him. And he walked to the box, stood inside, and bowed to the people in thanks. Lincoln's entry to Ford's Theater at his greatest moment of victory must have been a magical thing to see, and that I would have wanted to see.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. Our guest this hour is James Swanson, and his latest book is Bloody Crimes, The Chase for Jefferson Davis and the Death Pageant for Lincoln's Corpse. James is the author of Manhunt. We interviewed him for that book. It became a huge bestseller, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer. And this book looks at the month of April 1865 and the fall of Richmond. It looks at Jefferson Davis and Lee and the retreat of Davis and the fall of the Confederacy, and then very interesting material of what happens to Davis after he's captured and released. And it also deals with the glorious Abraham Lincoln and how he was looking intently at the victories and relishing the end of the Civil War. And there is a very, very large portion of the book that looks at his assassination and then the funeral train that went from Washington to Springfield, Illinois, and who... And it looks a great deal at how Mary Todd Lincoln responded to the assassination and what an absolute wreck she was and who greeted Lincoln and how he became, he was an important figure, but how he became a mythical figure as a result of this long train trip. So, okay, let's take your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for James. Let's start with Adam from Milwaukee. Hi, Adam.
Good morning. I'd like to at least briefly explore the possibility of some sort of foreign involvement in the assassination of the president. As many Americans know, the conspiracy was quite a bit wider than simply murdering Lincoln. There were attacks attempted on members of his cabinet as well by other people other than John Wilkes Booth. And I'm just wondering, you know, that the last time the English were involved in a war with the United States was 1812. That was less than 50 years before the beginning of the Civil War. And I believe during the Revolutionary War, some American forces actually entered Canadian territory, battling the British. And Canada itself was a rather unstable country to our north. I don't think Canada actually became a unified nation until probably around the 1940s. So I'm just wondering if there was... And also there were ironclad naval vessels being manufactured in Great Britain to be sold to the Confederacy. And so I'm wondering if there was any involvement by either the Canadian government or maybe through them to the English and there could have been some elements in the English government.
All right, let's get a response to that, Adam.
Okay.
James.
Well, certainly England was sympathetic to the Confederacy. England helped provide supplies and other materials. The Confederacy hoped that England would join the war against the Union, but ultimately Great Britain could never align itself with the Confederacy that had slavery. There are many myths about possible conspiracies against Lincoln. Some of them include even that the Pope ordered the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. The Pope did send a crown of thorns to Jefferson Davis as tribute after he was captured, but was not involved. Another one of the myths was that Lincoln's own cabinet, including Secretary of War Stanton, plotted his murder. In fact, these are all myths. Jefferson Davis didn't order the death of Lincoln. The Pope didn't. The English didn't. The Catholic Church didn't. The man who ordered the assassination of Abraham Lincoln was the charismatic actor John Wilkes Booth, who organized his own band of conspirators to kill not only Lincoln, but Secretary of State Seward, who was almost stabbed to death in his bed, and Vice President Andrew Johnson, who was also marked for death that night, but he was spared because the man assigned to kill him became afraid, got drunk, and ran away. One of the biggest myths of the Lincoln story is that there were conspiracies of others to assassinate him. But I'm convinced, after studying this for a long time, that the idea to kill Lincoln was Booth's own. He organized his own conspiracy. We like to believe in these conspiracy theories, but in the case of the Lincoln assassination, it was John Wilkes Booth who plotted the murder.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people aren't aware of the attack, the horrific attack on Seward that night, how he almost died, and his son also was terribly beaten. It's incredible. The response to that among people in Washington and in the country must have been, oh, my goodness, what's happening to us?
Yes. Well, Booth got the reaction he wanted. Everyone assumed that the entire cabinet had been marked for death. perhaps a last-ditch Confederate force was planning on arriving in Washington at sunrise to take advantage of the confusion. People thought anything was possible, that anything could happen, and why not? Because it did. The president was dead. For the first time in American history, a president had been murdered. Another member of his cabinet had been stabbed to death, and it's a brutal scene. And the only way to think of it is imagine a heinous, bloody crime of the modern era, such as Charles Manson and the murders in Helter Skelter. That was the scene in the Seward Mansion near the White House. Bloody handprints on the wall. His daughter in her dress covered with blood. His sons with fractured skulls and wounds. War Department employees stabbed. Seward stabbed repeatedly. It's a little remembered but horrific attack.
Yeah. A lot of the book looks at the funeral train and in great detail. The movement of that funeral train, how it went across the country from Washington to Illinois, made Lincoln a mythical figure?
I think so. During his lifetime, Abraham Lincoln was just a man, and many people thought of him that way. People forget that, like Jefferson Davis, Abraham Lincoln was not universally beloved by his own people. There were strong dissenting forces who opposed and even despised Abraham Lincoln. There were vicious caricatures and cartoons and smears. We think politics today is tough. Go back to the Lincoln era and read the kinds of things that were said about politicians then. Nothing. What was considered forbidden to say. There were pockets of disloyalty in New York, Ohio, Indiana. Lincoln almost lost the presidential election of 1864, and in fact, he thought he was going to lose. And so he was not the saint when he was alive. He became the saint. The process began when he was carried to the Peterson House across the street from Ford's Theater, unconscious but alive, and there was an all-night death vigil of important visitors to the bedside, his family and others. And that began the transformation of Lincoln from an American man into an American saint. No one realized what impact this funeral procession was going to have. It was not the plan that to make him into this this American icon. The people wanted to see him again because he had come to Washington by train, and the cities he passed through in 1861 now wanted to bid farewell to him in death. The funeral train took on a magical power of its own. It was almost like the funeral car was like an ark of the American covenant, bound up with all these symbols and meanings of the Civil War. And I think one reason it had this great emotional impact was it wasn't only Abraham Lincoln coming home on that train. As Walt Whitman said in the greatest American poem, When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloom, not for you alone. Whitman talked about coffins all. Mm-hmm. And so many men were lost in that war, over 300,000 dead from the North. Many of them never had their bodies shipped home. Many of them were buried in anonymous graves or where they had fallen in battle. And so I think the people of the Union viewed the Lincoln train is somehow bringing magically back home with Lincoln every single man lost in that war, every husband, every brother, every father, every lover, every sweetheart lost in that war was somehow coming home symbolically with Lincoln on that train.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible to imagine today the emotional impact. When people ask what was it like, I say, imagine the funeral of John F. Kennedy or imagine the emotional impact of 9/11 and then multiply that. And you'll get an approximation of how America responded to the murder and the majestic nationwide funeral of the president.
Yeah. Well, and I think of, as you were talking about that, I was thinking of his Gettysburg Address, which I don't think is his best speech, but it certainly is so moving. And it does the same thing in a way that the funeral train did. I didn't think of, you know, we're looking at all the dead and they're being on the train with him. He did the same thing with that address and will forevermore. It addresses not only the Civil War veterans, it addresses all veterans, that these dead shall not have died in vain. It was one of those speeches that brings the entirety of war to bear.
Yes, and interestingly enough, you know, it has nothing to do with the Lincoln funeral train. Jefferson Davis, near the end of his life, gave a similar speech about not dying in vain. When he went on that speaking tour and he spoke in Alabama, at the very spot he was inaugurated president 25 years before, he talked about the dead. And he said, I can see them now. Some of them weighed less than their rifles and backpacks. I remember those boys and shed tears as they marched to the Carnival of Death. And then Davis paused and said, but they are not dead. They live.
Hmm.
And very Lincoln-esque. It was one of his best speeches. And, of course, the parents of many of those boys were in that audience. And that was the moment that Davis's resurrection began, when he expressed this Lincoln-like sentiment in remembrance of the dead.
Yeah, except it couldn't possibly be Lincoln-like sentiment because he was on the wrong side, you know?
Yes,
very
yes.
Very much the wrong side. Thanks, Adam, very much for the call. John in Glendale, hi.
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 I'd like to talk a little bit about the funeral. When John F. Kennedy died, there was tremendous pressure on Jackie Kennedy to have a state funeral at the National Cathedral. Johnson and other Democratic leaders in the Congress put pressure on her. She remained firm. We had the Requiem Mass that was so appropriate with Cardinal Cushing at St. Matt's. But he was buried over at Arlington. And I'm wondering a couple things. I'd like your guest to talk about the actual funeral itself, whether or not there was any pressure on Mrs. Lincoln to have Lincoln's body be buried somewhere in the Washington, D.C. area. And then because of this long cortege back to Illinois, what were the embalming techniques back
yes.
in 1865 like? Because they had to preserve that body.
Yeah, James writes extensively about that in his book.
Yes. Well, regarding the issue of where Lincoln should be buried, that was quite a contentious thing because a number of people in D.C. argued strenuously that he should be buried in the U.S. Capitol in the crypt that had been intended for George Washington. The Commissioner of Public Buildings, Benjamin Brown French, who was in charge of the Capitol building and the White House building and the other major federal buildings, plotted extensively to try to make that happen behind the scenes. Other cities begged for the body, including Chicago, where Lincoln had enjoyed many triumphs, including his nomination for the presidency in 1860. And Lincoln likely would have returned to Chicago and not Springfield if he had served out his second term. Springfield desperately wanted the body. Before even consulting with Mary Lincoln, they bought an entire block of the city and intended to create a gigantic monument to Lincoln. That infuriated Mary, and she threatened to send the body elsewhere, to keep it in Washington or send it to Chicago. And Kentucky wanted it because Lincoln was born there. And so there was much argument and disagreement about where Lincoln would be buried. And Mary Lincoln ultimately agreed to Springfield. Mary Lincoln didn't love Springfield. She was disliked by many people there. And she had mixed feelings about letting the body go back there. But ultimately, she and her eldest son, Robert, decided that's where he would go after a lot of discussion.
And
now,
she,
in terms of... Sorry,
she didn't even get on the train. Can you tell that
no.
story?
No. Yes. Well, Mary Lincoln never viewed Lincoln's body at the White House. One of the little-known stories I tell is what happened to Lincoln between the time he died on the morning of April 15th and he was carried downstairs to the East Room in the White House for his state funeral, and then the procession took him down Pennsylvania Avenue to Lyon State in the Rotunda. It's a fascinating thing how Lincoln was brought back to his White House, carried up the stairs that morning he died, and his coffin, and it wasn't even a coffin, it was a plain wooden pine box, an ammunition crate or a rifle crate. His naked body was removed from this crate. It had been wrapped in an American flag, and he was laid on boards spread across two trestles. And Lincoln was autopsied in his own White House. U.S. Army surgeons sawed through his skull, removed his brain, and one of the doctors who had Lincoln's brain in his hands and who was holding it over a basin to wash it had the bullet slip through the brain tissue and drop into that basin and make an echoing sound, very haunting, which he writes about in an obscure letter that has been discovered. And so then the embalmers came, the same men who embodied the body of Lincoln's 11-year-old son, Willie, who had died in the White House in 1862. They were primitive chemicals. Now, embalming was once considered quite unacceptable in America. It was considered morbid and distancing between the family and the deceased. But because so many men had died in the Civil War and so many families wanted the bodies of their loved ones brought home, embalming prospered. and develop new techniques. And bombers roam the battlefields looking for customers.
Really?
They set up tents. Lincoln even once signed a document allowing some embalmers to solicit customers. Despite these techniques that could preserve a body for some time, they were not intended to allow someone to go unburied for 20 days like Lincoln did.
Right.
It was spring. There was no refrigeration. They planned to take him across the country and display his body in the major cities of the North, where 1 million people, including 100,000 children, came to view his corpse. An undertaker and an embalmer rode on that train, and they constantly inspected Lincoln's body. They applied new makeup and potions to his face, and he did begin to decompose on that journey, which is one of the reasons why, at every stop, his coffin was surrounded by hundreds, thousands of beautiful flowers, because their sweet odor would mask any other scent. And newspapers were very delicate about reporting this, but we do have eyewitness testimony that by the time Lincoln arrived in Springfield, he looked like a ghoulish, gruesome wax effigy of a man.
Oh, good story. Thanks, John, for your call. Jeff in Madison, hi.
Hello, Mr. Swanson. I just wanted to say, love Manhunt. Great book, and I just have three questions to ask you.
Okay.
My first question is, how active was Jefferson Davis in establishing Confederate slave colonies in Mexico? My second question is, the calling card, or purportedly the calling card that Booth gave the guard in front of Lincoln's box, was that a calling card, or was it something else, and why wasn't that investigated further? And my last comment is, if you could talk about maybe like some of the lifelike characteristics surrounding the places in which Booth died, the Garrett Farm and Ford's Theater. It was in the press, and the people that gave these buildings, these places, lifelike characteristics. I was just wondering if you could comment.
Yes. Well, first, I really don't know anything about Davis and slaves in Mexico, so let me put that aside. And you asked about the piece of paper Booth showed to gain entry to Lincoln's box. Well, Lincoln's valet, Charles Forbes, was sitting on a chair near the entry to Lincoln's private theater box. And eyewitness testimony that I believe says that Booth showed some sort of piece of paper to that man and then entered the box. I don't consider it that significant because Booth was so famous and so well known that he didn't need a piece of paper to get into that box. He could have just said, "I'm John Wilkes Booth. I would like to pay my greetings to the president." Lincoln knew who Booth was. He had seen him on stage. And so there's no secret story behind that. We don't know what it was. We don't know if it was a calling card, a note, or whatever. But I argue it's not that important because Booth would have gotten into that box no matter what. Now, regarding Ford's Theater and the Peterson House, it after Lincoln's death, the Ford Theater was viewed as something that was evil. Anyone connected to that theater was viewed as a possible suspect. And Secretary of War Stanton decided that the place where Lincoln had been assassinated must never become a place of entertainment and laughter and merriment. And so the theater was essentially seized by the government from the Ford brothers. They were eventually compensated. And it was stripped of its identity. Crews went in and removed all the decorations, the seats, the lighting. And it was gutted. And it's as though the government sentenced Ford's Theater to death as a playhouse. And they transformed it into a government office, which ultimately led to mass death. Because decades later, somebody filed one piece of paper too many in this government storehouse of records.
Oh, my.
And all the floors collapsed, killing approximately 20 government workers by crushing them to death and crippling 60 or 70 more. It's the last tragedy of Ford's Theater, and it's been totally forgotten. Dozens killed and dozens more terribly wounded and injured when the whole flooring collapsed because under the tremendous weight of all the government documents kept there.
Oh, my. I had no idea that that had happened. Tell me just a little bit, a sidelight here, on the Advisory Council of the Ford's Theater Society, which helped reconstruct Ford's Theater?
Yes, yes. The Ford's Theater was originally reconstructed and rebuilt in 1968. But in the years since then, the physical plant deteriorated. Everything was needed. Wiring, air conditioning, heating, new dressing rooms for the actors. And Ford's Theater also never had a lobby where people could go and either have receptions or meetings or go between the plays. The society is very involved in keeping Ford's Theater alive as a living playhouse, and we're absolutely convinced that Lincoln would have approved of this. He loved the theater. He wouldn't have wanted Ford's Theater to be just a morbid memorial to his murder. He would like to know, I'm sure, that there's life in Ford's Theater, that there are performances, many of which honor him or about the Civil War.
Mm.
And so the Ford's Theater Society and the National Park Service redid the entire hidden interior of the theater, all the wiring and all the other things, and improved it everywhere, and then built a beautiful lobby next door where people can gather, and then bought a building across the street, which is going to become an education center and an adjunct to Ford's Theater and have exhibits and displays and other museum artifacts. And also the basement museum, which has all these wonderful relics of the assassination, has been reimagined. So it covers not only the death of Lincoln, but life in wartime Washington, Lincoln's journey to Washington, and other important issues.
Interesting.
And the theater work was finished in time for Lincoln's bicentennial in 2009. And right now, the work is going on across the street from Ford's Theater on this new visitor center and education center. And also, much-needed repairs are also being done to the Peterson House where Lincoln died.
Oh. And when will that work be done?
That work should be done within a year.
Oh, good. James Swanson is our guest. His new book is Bloody Crimes, The Chase for Jefferson Davis and the Death Pageant for Lincoln's Corpse. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. More calls and emails in a moment here on the Ideas Network. James, here's an email that's come in from Jeanette in Milwaukee. After a lifetime of reading and studying Lincoln, I still don't feel as if I really know what it was like to live in that period. Manhunt certainly came close to being there. Does the author have that innate sense of actually feeling he was or is there at the time of these events?
Often, yes, in a few different ways. First, I've built a huge personal library of thousands of books on the Civil War.
Oh, my.
But also original Civil War newspapers, not photocopies, not microfilm. Original prints from the Civil War or documents or relics. Or I'll go and see these things. For example, I've actually held in my hand Booth's spinal column.
Oh, my goodness.
Penetrating it. And I've gone to Ford's Theater over 100 times, the Peterson House over 100 times. So I find that if I'm touching artifacts or original materials from that time, or if I'm at the place where something happened, it gives me a better feeling. And if I could, I'd like to give you one good example of that.
Yeah.
And this experience really convinced me that I should write this book. In Washington, D.C., in Georgetown, there's a cemetery called Oak Hill. In a far corner of that cemetery, in a place you'd never find unless you knew where to look for it, lies the tomb where Willie Lincoln was kept during his father's presidency.
Hmm.
Lincoln would often visit this tomb and mourn for his boy. When I stand at this tomb, and there's no sign that Willie was ever there because the tomb was loaned to Lincoln by the clerk of the U.S. Supreme Court, Thomas Carroll, and you can look through the iron gates and see the slots are niches where the coffins would slide into the tomb. And I look at those and think, Abraham Lincoln once stood here, and his little boy was lying in a coffin right at this spot where I stand now. No one goes there. If you go there, no one will bother you. You can have the place to yourself. When I stood at that spot, I thought, now I know how to write this book, and this book is going to begin with the reader standing at that tomb, imagining this story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's at moments like that, I feel almost like I was there.
Mm-hmm. Mm, quite a story. Let's go to Patricia in Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. I tuned in late, so I don't know what all has been covered here, but I grew up in the Chicago area, and in the late 40s, they had a railroad fair downtown by the lakeshore, and they did a reproduction of Lincoln's funeral train, and it's just etched in my mind. I can remember they had all these dark brown or green, dark green cars and all the purple bunting on them. I don't know how authentic it was, but It was a very moving thing to see. And if people have not been down to the Lincoln Museum in Springfield, Illinois, oh, they should go. It is just that, too, has such an effect on a person.
Yeah, but the whole Springfield, I love Springfield, the whole town.
I do have to mention, can I offer a dissenting view of one particular thing in Springfield, though, at the museum?
Of course, of course.
Well, this is the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Now, my view is John Wilkes Booth is a racist and a murderer who killed the greatest American. If you go to the Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, you'll find a life-size, wax-like figure of John Wilkes Booth standing within sight of other life-size figures of the Lincoln family, General Sherman, even Frederick Douglass. Then, in another part of the museum, there's a tableau of the box at Ford's Theater with John Wilkes Booth assassinating Lincoln. Then, on opening day of that museum, I found in the gift shop for sale to America's children toy replica Derringer pistols.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
Used by Booth to kill Lincoln.
Ooh.
Now, you know, maybe I'm being prudish. I don't know what you'd call it. But I find it personally objectionable that in a museum dedicated to Abraham Lincoln, there are not one but two life-size wax figures of his murderer. And I ask you this. If you would go to the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, would you want or expect to see a life-size wax figure of Lee Harvey Oswald? Hmm. Would you like to see at the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta or at the Lorraine Motel where he was murdered in Tennessee, would you expect to see or want to see a life-size figure of James Earl Ray pointing a rifle out a window at Dr. King? We would be outraged by that. And just because it happened a long time ago, I think, doesn't mean it's proper that in Springfield, there is a presidential library that is a waxworks of an assassin. There's just something I don't like about it. It is my hope that one day the wax figures of John Wilkes Booth will be removed from Lincoln's Museum.
Point well taken. Dave on the road. Hi, Dave.
Yes. My question was regarding Jefferson Davis. I'd understood that as he fled Richmond, one story goes that he dressed like in woman's clothes in order to escape capture.
Is that true?
Yes. No, it's not. One of the myths is the day he was captured, 6 weeks later in near Irwin, Georgia, on May 10th, 1865, the rumor is Jefferson Davis was captured wearing one of his wife's hoop skirts and a bonnet. Partly to show that isn't true, in my book, I have photographs of the actual clothing that Jefferson Davis was wearing when he was captured. And that puts to rest the idea that he was dressed in the hoop skirt. He wore a raincoat or an overcoat. He wasn't dressed in a hoop skirt. It's funny, that didn't stop P.T. Barnum from offering $500 to the U.S. government for the hoop skirt so he could exhibit it at his American Museum in New York City. And when the government wouldn't sell it because there was no hoop skirt to sell, that didn't stop Barnum. He did a wax figure of Davis dressed as the woman, surrounded by soldiers capturing him. And that survived just a few months till July 1865 when the museum caught fire. And amid the flames, someone ran inside. They threw the wax figure of Jefferson Davis to the crowd below. The crowd in the streets captured it with glee, and they dragged it to a lamppost, and they hanged the figure of Jefferson Davis while singing a song about hanging Davis to the on the sour apple tree.
Oh, my. Thanks, Dave. Can you speak briefly, Carson in Lake Geneva, we have about a minute left, to the attempted theft of Lincoln's body years later from the Springfield crypt?
Yes. There was an attempt around July 4th, 1876, to steal Lincoln's body and hold it for a ransom. The attempt was thwarted. Detectives found out about it. And it caused Lincoln to be sunk deep below tons of stone and concrete and marble in a gigantic tomb. I don't think Lincoln would have wanted this massive, huge tomb to him in Springfield. Lincoln was such a simple man of simple tastes. I think he would have been happy with a little tomb like George Washington has at Mount Vernon. The tomb is so un-Lincoln-like that when I go to Springfield and visit that tomb, I don't feel the presence of Abraham Lincoln because it's not something he would have chosen.
Jeff, are you there? Well, Jeff isn't there, so we'll say goodbye. Thank you so much for being with us and for writing this, James. And you tell a story that you got to keep listening to, I must say. You're very, very
good. Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. James Swanson, the latest book is Bloody Crimes, The Chase for Jefferson Davis and the Death Pageant for Lincoln's Corpse. And we want to tell you a couple things. One is that we have had some emails posted about special events taking place, the Marathon County Historical Society, a Civil War item roll call. We'll post all of that on our Facebook page because it's too much to tell you about right now. Go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and stay tuned. As he was talking about this, stay tuned for announcements about a trip to Washington, D.C. Stay tuned. Might be coming up. Thank you, Chrissy Pease, Rhonda Fanning, for producing this program. And thank you for listening to this program and for calling. Donna Brazil is our All Things Political guest on Monday. Should be a good show. Until then, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.